Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready for more propaganda? Well, you're in the wrong place at the right time. Columbo Chronicles is for critical thinkers. Let's welcome the consumer advocate for justice. Here's the Rose, Rose Columbo.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose, Rose Columbo, right here for you on Columbo Chronicles and the Justice Club, because we all know there is very little justice left in the world today, and some people believe there is no justice. Well, a few believe there is plenty of justice. All depends on where you're at in your mind. So welcome, welcome here, because Columbo Chronicles and the Justice Club is here to empower you, enlighten you, expand your mind with Rose Columbo's commentary on justice and injustice from her famous book, Fight Back Legal Abuse. So watch for Fight Back Legal Abuse coming soon. That'll be Fight Back Legal Abuse 2. And Fight Back Legal Abuse 1 was published in 2010, an international Irwin Award winner that went global in newspapers and magazines around the world. And enlightened and did empower a lot of people on how justice is for sale for many, many people. So the question I asked is, how much justice can you afford? Well, it's getting pretty expensive for food, so just imagine how much there is an increase in legal fees. So stay out of trouble. Stay away from the courts, if possible. So today, though, we have a very dynamic guest, and he is an expert and an author, because that's what we do. We enter into the world of experts and authors on Columbo Chronicles. Sometimes we enter into the Justice Club, depending on the topic, because we have a myriad of topics, from romance to health to mafia to crime, constitution, politics, divorce, abuse, the world, and what is happening around the world, with experts mostly from America and authors mostly from America, but sometimes we get international authors and experts as well. And we get their point of views and what they think is happening around the world or about their intriguing books. So if this is your first time listening, again, my name is Rose Columbo, and I am the legendary advocate for justice. I turned from not just being an advocate for justice, but turned into an award-winning media host, producer, author, and poet, and received many awards, just so you feel that information is credible. And I've been a host for 30 years, believe it or not, helping victims of legal abuse become survivors. But today, we are going to enter into the world of authors and experts with a very dynamic guest, and his name is Jonathan N. Pruitt. He's a PhD, an educator, and he's turned author, and we are honored to have him share his intriguing book entitled The Amber Menhir. We are going to welcome our special guest, Jonathan N. Pruitt, and we are going to ask him how to properly pronounce menhir. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, M-E-N-H-E-E-R, and to actually define it for those who don't know what it is. And then we're going to turn to our author in just a few minutes, who will tell us more about his background, how he went from living in an economically disadvantaged neighborhood in Florida, and his determination to earn. So we'll discover more about our author and his wonderful travels and why he chose to write a fantasy series, and if world building is dangerous. Now that really caught my eye. So I can't wait to speak with our very special guest. So don't touch that dial, because Columbo Chronicles will enter into the world of authors and experts in just a moment after these very important messages. So stay with us.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Colombo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world. Written with an Orwellian twist, will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Colombo, available at Amazon.com.
You're listening to the Colombo Chronicles with Rose Colombo. Your comments and questions are always welcome, and don't forget to share and follow. Now, back to our show with Rose Colombo.
Yes, we're nearly back to our show, so hold on a second.
The Justice Club is back on Colombo Chronicles live podcast. Join Rose Colombo at noon and find out what tips she will provide in a world of little justice.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
Yes, this is the Rose, and we are back on Colombo Chronicles Live, and we're happy to have you with us because we have a really special guest, and we also have a great topic. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about our author, Jonathan N. Pruitt, PhD, educator turned author. He is a lifelong educator turned fantasy author. His real life redemption arc took him from being a child prodigy in an economically disadvantaged rural county in Florida to obtaining his PhD at the age of 24, and then to an international scandal in 2020 that attacked his research methods. Jonathan has taught and traveled around the world. He is an enigmatic ball of energy that will bring humor, biting human insights, the perspective of a scientist, and the creative spirit of an inventor to my audience and to his audience today as well. So we will just tune into and enter into the world of authors and experts and get started. And let's say hello to our special guest. Hi, Jonathan. How are you doing today?
Hey, Rose. I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you because your book is really intriguing. I looked up some information about it online as well. I always do that. And So... first of all, Jonathan, will you tell our audience the correct pronunciation of Menhir? I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
It. I mean,
and
so,
what is
if you want
the definition
well,
of it? Oh, I'm sorry. And what is the definition of it?
Perfect. Yeah. So let's see. The Amber Menhir. So you can dwell on that H or you can be softer about it. It doesn't matter. You can say it either which way. So. The Amber Menhir, and menhirs in our world are these weird standing stones that are speckled across Western Europe and the UK. And basically, they're these giant stones that'll be in the middle of fields or, you know, otherwise unpopulated landscapes. And they often provide evidence that there were societies there, people that lived and had a culture and oftentimes had interesting technologies to erect these giant stones to stand up. And but that society is gone. It is no longer present. It's vanished. And some of the only evidence that we'll have that was ever a society there to begin with are these giant stones that are like these towers in the middle of nowhere. And so they inspire a lot of myth and superstition and fear in some, but then they're also a testament to human strength and ingenuity, even very early in our history.
Yes, I agree with that, because some of those stones are so gigantic that you have to just wonder how in ancient times did they even move those stones or pile them up, and they lasted forever. They need
it lasted
something
longer
we don't
than most
know.
Of ours, though. Yeah. I mean, many of our buildings will be long gone, but those menhirs will still be around for thousands of years.
Seriously. So that was intriguing. Thank you for that. So let me ask you, why are you writing a fantasy series to begin with?
Well, you know, I always loved fantasy novels. You know, growing up, I was an energetic little boy that had a hard time sitting still for almost anything. And, you know, fantasy books are some of the first books that trick a lot of young kids, boys and gals, into reading. And, you know, although I could barely sit still, I could find myself sitting still for hours to read things like The Chronicles of Narnia or The Lord of the Rings. And, you know, through those books, I became a lover of books in general and found myself reading lots of different genres. But I've always returned to fantasy as sort of an escapism from, you know, the horrors or trials or stresses of our world. And they've provided both a sense of escapism, and then for the politically minded fantasy novels, they also can provide interesting commentary. And so I always wanted to write a fantasy novel. And, you know, a couple of years ago, as you hinted at, I was in a philosophical pause in my career and life story. And I thought, like, what am I going to do now? Like, and at the time, people were doubtful of, like, the veracity or the truthfulness of anything that I was saying. And so I was so afraid that I was like, well, what am I going to do for the rest of my life if, like, if everyone doubts the truth of anything I say? I was like, well, wait a minute. Well, that's only bad if you intend to say something truthful in the future. But if I make my next work, my next enterprise, writing something, composing something, devoting myself to something that, at least to the letter, wasn't true, then that would be okay. So, you know, fantasy, of course, the whole premise is that it's not true. And, you know, along the way while writing these books, I have to say, I was able to provide more truthful commentary and statements than I ever could contemplate trying to write in nonfiction. The sorts of things I get to write in this book would get me sued in the real life, if I tried to say them. So I've enjoyed writing this fantasy novel.
Yes, I agree that there's truth in fiction and that you can get away with more doing fiction than you can with the truth in today's world. That is an absolute today. So, you know, I was interested because when I read your background and it said you were a child prodigy in an economically disadvantaged rural county in Florida, and then you obtained your PhD at the age of 24, coming from a disadvantaged rural county, that had to be pretty difficult and a great achievement. So what drove you to do that, and how did you do that for those who are seeking to improve their lives?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think a lot of people where I grew up were trying to escape in one way or another. most kids tried to do it through sports, right? So a lot of the kids that I went to school with, you know, not a lot of them, but a small number, became professional athletes. More of them, but went to college for free through sports. And so many of us were trying to achieve our way out of the communities that we were in, because if we'd stayed in them exclusively, the number of opportunities to us might have been fewer. So I basically, as a child, took an inventory of my skill set, and I thought, well, you know, I'm not particularly gifted at sports. I'm not terrible, but, you know, I'm probably not going to be playing in a college, at a college level or for any sort of professional team. And so I was pretty good at school, and I thought, well, you know, I'll try to be as accomplished as I can in school. And so I did that. I devoted myself to my studies, and it paid dividends along the way. And so, you know, I got accolades and whatnot. And then because I went to a high school where there weren't a lot of AP classes or advanced classes, it didn't take long in high school before I ran out of math to take and I ran out of science to take. And so by default, they sent me away to college. And from there, I started attending college at around 15, and I graduated from my undergraduate degree at 20, and I had my PhD by 24. And, you know, I just kept my nose to the grindstone. And, you know, I have to say, Rose, if you try, most things in life, if you devote an effort, if you push yourself into it, you will succeed, and it will pay dividends. Effort pays off. And once it does, success is addictive. And so, you know, if you begin to succeed, it creates a positive feedback loop. I tried to pick myself up by my bootstraps and make something of myself, and it kind of worked.
Well, I think it did work, and obviously. And so you became an educator, but then you also, in your bio, say that it led to an international scandal in 2020 that attacked your research methods. What were your research methods, and what was the attack against you?
Yeah, I have to say their concern was founded. And so, like, I was going all over the world at the time intercepting tropical cyclones. So I'm a spider biologist by training. So I'm the world's most evil spider biologist, which is both exciting and also disappointing. You would imagine more from an evil spider biologist, but, you know, I'm the best we've got. So, I was traveling all over the world intercepting tropical cyclones. So basically, you know, when we have a hurricane coming for the eastern United States or the Caribbean, we have newscasters and people who are saying, you know, it's coming, prepare yourself, tape up your windows, put all your belongings in storage, or, you know, or escape to the interior of whatever state you're in for a little while and away from the coast. But animals don't have that. So, you know, animals don't have, like, the Weather Channel to frighten them into preparing for storms. So, like, instead, they have to have some sort of instinct or something that tells them what to do and to prepare for those things. And so I was basically trying to figure out what animals do to prepare for these scary storms. And what I was in Australia, actually, the time, in the rainforest in Australia, so north of Cairns and Townsville. And so I was up there in Port Douglas. If you have listeners that know where this is, so it's like it's the hinterlands of Australia, middle of nowhere. And a couple of people have noticed in my data sets, you know, at this point I had maybe 170 papers that were published. People noticed in about three or four of my data sets that there were copy and paste events. So like the exact same values in the exact same order showed up in the exact same sequence multiple times. And the problem with that is that there's no reason procedurally why that should be. And so because it was discovered first in three papers and then more than a dozen, everyone in the world thought, oh my God, this child prodigy, this really successful early career scientist who rocketed to fame. It appeared, you know, scientific fame, whatever that means. but it's an oxymoron. But, you know, it appeared like it was too good to be true. And then people reached the conclusion that it must have been deliberate manipulation. And, you know, as part of this formal process, I was required to be silent in the public view because there was an internal process I had to adhere to, and it had to remain completely confidential. And while that happened, you know, several of my works, more than a dozen of my articles were retracted, and which means I had to pull them back from public view and say, hey, these are too questionable. We can't leave these in the public eye any longer. I'm sorry. But it turns out in the end that if you, in total, these copy and paste events were something like less than 2% of the data. And if you remove them, the results of the studies don't change. And so in the end, they concluded that the copy and paste events were probably deliberate, at least that's what the committee decided, even though they didn't change the results. And people later replicated most of those results. So, you know, I'm either very good at guessing what happens with spiders or, you know, there was something to those studies. But in the meantime, my reputation was so badly damaged that, you know, frankly, you know, I mean, I can't say by what entities, but several entities had me sign NDAs, and they paid me damages, and I moved on with my life. But while that was happening, I was basically trapped in this multi-year process, and I thought, what am I going to do? Like, I can't just sit around and watch TV and watch Netflix. I have to be doing something that feels productive. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to start writing. I always wanted to write, and I told myself I was going to become a fantasy author in my 40s, but it turns out my 40s happened about 5 years earlier by gunpoint, and you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles.
Well, we never know what twists and turns are going to happen in today's world. And so, you know, you have to think outside the box, exactly like you said. You can't sit around and watch Netflix all day. You have to figure out, okay, what am I capable of doing and what do I think I can succeed at and still get my message out through writing. And so I think that's exactly what you did. And I think a lot of people have to do that in today's world because everything seems to be censored and the truth is mostly censored today. So, critical thinking, I should say, seems to be censored today. So I'm glad you wrote your fictional book. So it's going to be a series, correct?
Yeah, the first one came out. And of course, you know, even before the series came out, more than 50,000 academics saw that I was writing this book and were outraged. And so, like, no matter what I did, before the book was even cracked open, people were upset. And so it's been kind of a fun ride already. But, yeah, the first book is out, The Amber Veneer, and that came out October 3rd and debuted quite well thanks to, I think, people being curious what I might have put on those pages. And then, you know, it's the second book is drafted, and so is the third in the series. There will be 5 in total. And I envision releasing them about one per year in the summer.
Yes. Well, let's get into your book and let's talk about it. So I also wanted to ask you, because you talk about you read also, did you not, through your travels and living in deserts, jungles, and more.
Oh, yes.
What was that experience like and how did it affect your book?
Oh, I mean, to some degree, I was completely spoiled being an academic. You know, I got to travel all over the world and study whatever questions really came to me. And, you know, because I grew up sort of trapped in a life that was not affluent, I always wanted to travel as I got older. And so as soon as I had that opportunity to study weird animals in weird places, that's exactly what I did. And so I ended up spending, you know, a couple of years. I lived in Namibia, which is a desert nation on the northwest border of South Africa. It used to be part of South Africa. And it's just basically two big deserts there, the Kalahari and the Namib Desert. And I would spend months of my year there in a country that, after Mongolia, is the least populated country on Earth. And I've lived in East Ecuador and the Amazon and the rainforest in Australia. But, you know, it sounds very exotic, but a lot of my time was either spent in the car driving to go intercept a storm, or I was spent after a storm with all of the power knocked out. And so when that happens, epic fantasy novels, they take up a lot of space. They take up a lot of time. They take a long time to read. So they provided my entertainment. And sometimes, you know, it sounds kind of sad to say it out loud, companionship when there was no one else around. And so, you know, the nice thing about this is that when I write about a landscape in my books, where I describe animals that are, you know, fantastical and mythical, I have a lot of experience with weird animals on Earth. So I get to write about those sorts of creatures with a kind of specificity and authenticity that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And because I spent so much of my adult life alone in these remote regions, I also got to digest a lot of fantasy literature and other kinds of literature too, without people telling me how I should feel about it. And so I could reflect on it on my own and think about and come up with my own views about how I thought about various kinds of authors, and including authors that are maligned.
Mm-hmm. So I know that you're interested in world building, but also you say it can be dangerous. So how is it dangerous to speak out about world building? What are the dangers?
Yeah, there are a few things. Like one, I mean, there's two aspects to this. As a storyteller, world building is a basic element of fantasy and sci-fi. You have to describe, you think, like, in this fantastical world, what's there, who's there, what are the major conflicts in society, or for the environment, or for your individual characters, and how does the story fit into that realm? So many people are interested in the world building aspect of their world. that there are people online, tens of thousands of people or more, that have written about beautiful, interesting fantasy worlds that know, they know what their fictitious gods are like and what their fictitious history is like and their fictitious evolutionary ecology of force A, B, and C and like what creatures live in the bottom of the ocean. But the problem is that you'll spend so much time doing that that you can become overwhelmed with just that process and you forget to write a story. I mean, an actual story about a character, because all stories have to start somewhere, and they have to start probably with just one or a couple of characters and about a problem they're having, an event in their lives. And so as a storyteller, I think you can spin your wheels a real long time about how to create this world and what it's like, and then you forget to write the story itself. And then when you begin to write the story, many authors are so anxious to tell you about this elaborate, fictitious world that they've created that what they write comes off as like an encyclopedia rather than of a fictitious world rather than a story that we can relate to. And so I started off with a character that has a mommy complex relationship with her mother. And many of us, even if our mothers are saints, our mothers can drive us crazy. And likewise, our children can drive us crazy, no matter how much we love them. So, you know, I thought, you know, parent-offspring tension, parent-child tension is something that everyone can relate to. So I started off with that kernel, and then slowly, in my book, I slowly give you aspects of the world, and only a little bit at a time, because honestly, I'd rather you focus on what the characters are thinking, about their views on topics, and about the commentary I'm weaving along the way, rather than why this tree to the right has the shape of leaves that it does and how that's helpful in an imaginary season that's about to happen. You know, I mean, I think you don't want to be too technical about your fictitious world. World building is also dangerous, though, because, as you've hinted at, in today's society, there are certain kinds of stories, certain kinds of commentary that if you veer too close to them, can backfire, can make it to where your story is no longer accessible. People will no longer want to read it. Well, people think that it should be forbidden, burned, removed. And so, you know, there are certain kinds of world building that if you tell the wrong kind of message, or if people get the hint that you might be providing the wrong kind of message, that can imperil your ability to have your work seen by people and appreciated.
Absolutely. That's a real serious issue today in today's world with artificial intelligence and Wall Street controlling our freedom of speech today, appears to me, rather than abiding by the United States Constitution that all people in America who are legal or natural-born Americans in our country have freedom of speech, opinions, because critical thinking is how we determine all the different opinions and truths and whatever else other people are writing to come to our own discernment and conclusions. And fiction is part of that. And it's an important part today because of what is happening to freedom of speech. And so, so tell us about how you used amalgamated biology of real organisms in creating your ecosystems.
Sure, absolutely. You know, like the neat thing is that I have all, you know, if you study animals, one of the most challenging questions somebody could ask me, and I'd bumble all over myself if you asked me this, like, what's your favorite animal? And, you know, I have so many different favorite animals for so many different reasons and, you know, aspects of their behavior or their biology or what they do or their habits. And so it becomes very challenging for me. But, you know, the neat thing about a fictitious animal is that now I can stitch together all of my favorite aspects of the biology of, you know, a half a dozen different animals. And what emerges from it is a believable organism that is unlike anything on Earth in its totality, but it's stitched together. Like if you go, everyone's seen Jurassic Park, the velociraptors, those scary hook-legged, fast-moving dinosaurs that are, you know, the thing of nightmares in Jurassic Park, those screams that those raptors have, those don't come out of thin air. Those are combinations of birds and seals and walruses and 20 different animals that have their real-life vocalizations stitched together to make this incredibly intimidating scream of this animal that resonates with us psychologically because it's like real things around us, and it seems realer because of that. And so I try to do that with the literary aspects of the animals in my book and the ecosystems as well. I stitched together real life biological concepts, truisms. I just put them together in a bricolage that makes it different and dissimilar in aggregate than anything that exists in our world. And it's actually kind of a fun exercise. I imagine one day I'll have a professional artist sketch the various animals, and I might try to pitch it to Smithsonian or something to run a little piece on it and, like, talk about, like, what am I actually teaching you about? You're inadvertently getting a biology lesson, except for I hope I'm dolling it up a little bit better than the average biology lesson.
Yes, you are. So why do you say that utopia and dystopias are the same thing?
This is the major crux of this book, is that it's a utopia. One kind of person, one kind of class of people in a philosophical view has reached its utopia in the book. So the book's premise is that there's a group of intellectuals who have identified that the world, this fictitious world, is in danger. And this danger is looming closer and closer. They call it calamity. So the idea is that the scholars have identified, intellectuals have identified that the world is moving closer and closer to a region of space, like outer space, that when their planet hits this space, all of life will be destroyed. And they call this space, this looming region, calamity. And it's thousands of years off, but it's still of great concern. They can see it's coming. But the scholars are part of a group of people, a rare group of people that have magical powers. They are, and because they have these magical powers, they've emerged as the most affluent members of society. And not only that, they're also society's best chance of circumventing this forthcoming doom that they've identified. And so the Meneers in my book are these schools of magic learning and research that emerged and reached prominence in this fictitious world, because they are humanity's best hope of coming up with a kind of magic that will be able to save humanity and everybody else. All of the strange life on this planet could be saved if they can only come up with the right kind of magic. But unfortunately, magic is very expensive, and everyone's going to have to work together to make sure that we have the best odds of circumventing this calamity. And of course, there's a conflict of interest, right? The average person cannot detect whether or not calamity is real. They have to rely on these magic-using individuals to determine whether or not it's there and determine whether or not they're going to be saved. And so it creates this big conflict of interest that this basically emerges as vampiric intellectuals have maybe tricked the world, or maybe it's authentic, into believing that it's in danger when they have every reason to lie about it and every reason to continue to enjoy this privileged position that they've created for themselves. And even if calamity is real, thousands of years from now, in everyday life, these scholars are exploiting their status in a way that is completely self-serving and diffuses their ability to make real progress, if indeed real progress needs to be made. And so, you know, you don't have to look far to see how there are intentional parallelisms to various issues in our world. And, you know, it echoes our world. So for these intellectuals, that's a utopia. They are getting all the resources that they need to follow whatever magical interests inspire them, and they get to enjoy a privileged aspect of society, and they're revered by the broader masses. But the person next to them, somebody who doesn't have those magical powers, that doesn't have this ability to enjoy this privileged position in life, they're experiencing a dystopia. In their world, they have almost no upward mobility. Their interests, self-interests, their ideas are completely discredited, out of hand, because they are not part of the solution to this calamity, whether or not that's even a real thing. And so I say dystopias and utopias are the same thing, because it's all a matter of perspective, Rose. Like, if we follow any of our views to the nth degree, and there's no countervailing view or alternative opinion that's espoused, if we take any view, even a well-intentioned one, eventually we'll reach a state where it's a utopia for the person who holds that view, who holds that opinion, and a dystopia for everybody else.
Yes, I can see that now that you explained it very clearly to us. That makes sense. So, you know, we hear about, you know, these in real life, we hear about the people behind the veil who are creating or seek to create a utopian world. Mm. And so, that is really intriguing, to say the least, because many people are concerned about that as well.
Yeah.
So
a utopia for
who? Part. Yeah, exactly. And so about your characters, and who do you think the readers will meet in the Amber Menhir?
Yeah, there are five major points of view, and the goal is to have various kinds of personality types and various kinds of perspectives. So like this major crux in society that has these privileged magic users and these, you know, lay society that sort of bleeds into their mouths. I wanted to make sure that I had characters that were on both sides of that. So we have a privileged, prepossessing, presumably going to be talented main character, Tara Langkrall, who is a new student to the Amber Menhir, and the Amber Menhir is one of these schools, and she's going there with great promise. She is allegedly going to be able to produce the rarest of these magical disciplines. She at least is alleged to be able to manipulate time once her abilities manifest. And she arrives with two other students that we follow the way through, Peony Bianchi, who is sort of a brash, outspoken, and unpolished young lady next to Tara. And then their sweet, stammering, giant friend, Roland, who, doesn't appear at face value to have great potential. And then we follow them, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, entering this Amber Menhir, this school, with the hope that they're going to be able to contribute to possibly saving humanity. And once they get there, they realize that not everything on the inside of the Amber Menhir is as described to the outside world, and that many of the scholars are more interested in political power plays on the interior and thwarting each other or swindling each other out of modicums of power rather than attending to the professed goals that they describe to the outside world. And the characters grow uncomfortable with this, and some of the less polished characters, say Peony or Roland, begin to question innocently the auspices of these schools. And when they do, they quickly find that, well, they have more than their grades on the line if they run counter to the prevailing order. And they soon realize that their lives are in danger and that they have to fight in order to even survive the fact that they questioned the prevailing order.
Sounds very close to home. So,
yes.
Believe me, I can relate to what your story is about. And so tell us about how your readers will unravel the various sides of conflicts, because there's a lot of conflicts going on, obviously.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the goal is, I interact with Catholic minors during the day. So I teach college biology to advanced Catholic students here in Tampa. But last year, a couple of my students were having a hard time with reading the book Frankenstein. And Mary Shelley's Frankenstein has this main scientist, Victor Frankenstein, who creates this creation, this monster, who initially it's not meant to be a monster, but this creation, this monster thing, runs off and basically enters a society where it starts killing people and menacing our main character, Victor Frankenstein. And we find out at the very end that the monster isn't a monster really at all. And the monster has this soliloquy where he tells Victor Frankenstein and the reader his side of the story, and like the fact that like all of these alleged evils that he's executing, that he's committing, he was actually doing in a way that kind of makes it all understandable. And that's not the way many conflicts are. Many conflicts, if you can really listen to the opposing view, it has glimmers of truth to it. It makes it relatable. And so the goal is, in one show that has five different points of view, in several chapters, you'll approach one of these major issues, like the fact that these scholars effectively drink blood in order to be able to survive and conduct their magic, the blood of everybody. And it sounds horrific. And then you find out later on that it might be essential. So from another character's perspective, you see, yeah, some of these scholars are squeamish about it, and some of these scholars are reverent about this blood that they're consuming from everybody, but some of them aren't. And so I try to lull you into a sense of what's right and wrong in one perspective of a character, and then confront you, like from the Victor Frankenstein's monster in the next chapter, an opposing view. And I think you know, I like I, from anyone from like a from a post-humanist who believes that, you know, like that animals should have the same rights as human beings, all the way to somebody who is an objectivist, like, you know, Ayn Rand. There are no human rights. There are no animal rights. People need to do what's best for themselves and to work hard for themselves, and that's how society moves forward. I like to hear everyone's views. As long as they can, you know, maintain their tempers, I like to hear all sides of a point of view before I begin to develop an opinion, and I like to think on things. I would never want to silence anyone. And in the book, I try to make sure that all sides of each of these key issues gets aired, and then I leave it to the readers to decide what's right and what's wrong. I never profess, at least so far, and I don't think I will in the series, I don't convey whether or not calamity is real. I provide hints support that it's real or that it might be fictitious, and I honestly leave it for the readers to decide what they think is more likely based on the available evidence. I never want to tell you how to feel about something, and that might frustrate some readers, but I think it's respectful.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that it leaves the mind. It helps expand the mind and get people mm-hmm. to think. So,
yep.
Yeah. So tell us about your own redemption story and what attributes do you have that bridge your former career and your new one as a fantasy writer.
Yeah, good question. So, you know, when I saw myself engulfed in these flames of like of political drama, and I saw social media going crazy, and like and pretty big magazines running stories that, you know, were disparaging to say the least, I thought, oh my God, I part of you instinctually wants to just curl up, have probably too many adult beverages, do something completely useless, and just and just hide. But you know that sort of short-term solution doesn't work for very long. And if you indulge in too much self-pity, then pretty soon doors are going to start closing. And so I thought, okay, I literally opened an Excel spreadsheet, how analytical. And I was like, okay, what are my strengths as a human being? Like, I have my health for at least another 15, 20 years, I probably have pretty good health. Okay, barring something, you know, any nasty surprises. Okay, I have a lot of energy. I like to talk to people. I love interacting with people. I've never met somebody I didn't like at face value. I like interacting with people. I like writing. I like communicating. And so I went down through this whole list, and I wrote all my strengths and what I viewed were gifts. And I said, okay, which of these things are completely broken by what's happened? They will never be resurrected. They're never going to be able to be brought back to life again. Which of them are damaged, but not irretrievably? How much of them will just require work in order to get those strengths back into working order? And which of them are intact? And I promise you, even if you feel like your life has exploded, your emotional house is on fire, don't panic. I think panicking under those circumstances is more likely to get you killed or more likely to get a bad outcome, in the literal sense, killed figuratively, but maybe literally. It was more likely to get you harmed than if you can just slowly get your wits about you, remind yourself that, like, you know, the game is not over unless you say it's over. So get your wits about you, study the buff, stiff upper lip, write down what you, and make a map for yourself of where you want to go next, and make some contingencies too. There will be roadblocks, and believe me, I'm still experiencing plenty of them, but there is no roadblock that cannot be worked around in some way or another. So, you know, keep a guiding star and remember what your strengths are and remember who you are and what you're capable of, and don't let what somebody else says about you define you. Good God.
Well, I agree with all of that, and I can relate to all of it. And mm-hmm. as an advocate for justice and an author.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, you made me laugh to myself because it was so funny because yesterday I was going through some things that were, you know, how some days it's one, two, three things keep piling up, you know, and you're like, oh
mm-hmm.
my God, you know. And I told a friend, I said, I think I'm going to move to Alaska, live in an igloo, and just talk to the seals and eat fish.
That would probably entertain you for a couple of weeks, and then you'd find seals are bad company.
And then I did what you said. I said, okay, you can dig your way out of this hole and start writing down the to-dos and the good and the bad and, you know, and figure it out. You know? But I believe like you do that you know, you can have your little moments of wanting to live in an igloo or My other one was being an eagle and just not having to pay Delta to fly around the world and see whatever you want to see and visit whatever you want to visit. So those are my two choices. But, you know, reality is that, okay, we are strong-minded people. So we have, you know, we have our health and our brains, and so we can use them to figure this out. I'm a true believer in that. You know, but I think it's okay to have a moment where you're like, oh, I just want to go live in an igloo.
Running away.
Because there's always
going to
be somebody who's attacking you no matter what you do. There's going to be people who love you, and there's going to be people who are like, oh, we got to shut this person down or silence them.
Yep.
And we have to be able to deal with that in today's world, which wasn't like that in the past in America, but it is today. And so these are the things we deal with. So tell me, let's see here. A few years ago, you took inventory, I believe, of things that, from just what you said, maybe even recently, that were bruised, broken, or intact. So tell us, taking stock of what you had and using that to bring something good into the world.
Yeah, I mean, every one of us is able, there's a story inside of you. There's probably multiple inside of you, inside of me, inside of all of us. And there are gifts inside of each of us that can be leveraged, that are unique to us. There's nobody on earth who has the same ensemble of gifts and abilities that you have, that I have, that any of your listeners have. And so the goal is not to let your own psychology, your own regrets, your own feelings of weakness or feelings of feeling overwhelmed, you get in your own way. You know, the human spirit is incredibly tenacious. And, you know, there are lots of times in our history when the best versions of ourselves only emerge under duress. And so when you're under duress, don't collapse, even if it's just you. It's one thing if you have a whole city surrounding an issue and it's under duress and you have a sense of community. Sometimes you have to be your own community. You have to be your own cheer squad, and that's particularly challenging. But you can do it. You have the same instincts as the people who claw their way out of a cave that's collapsed, or that run into a house and save someone that's on fire, or we're the same people. You have those same abilities, and just you're not weaker than those stories. You are those stories. Just tap into that and go be perhaps your own hero, but society's hero as well. Go inspire others by your tenacity, and don't be afraid of it.
Yes, I think that's good advice. So I want to ask you this particular question because we're running out of time.
Okay.
Why do you say that logic, philosophies, and stern motivations can take you to dangerous places?
Yes. Many ideas sound good in theory. There are little witticisms and things that just like, you know, they're like a little earworm. Like, oh, here's just a quick little witticism. And you're like, oh, that sounds good at face value. Lots of manipulations happen by a quick, like, slogan that implies a truth, implies a truism. But if you think about it critically, it falls apart. So, like, you know, in my book, I'm addressing a notion of collectivism. So, you know, like, you know, famously Ayn Rand was like, you know, came from a world where communism was destroying aspects of the real world. And in reaction to that, she said, hey, collectivism is bad. Doing something just because you think it's going to help everybody else, never mind you, that's too easily demonized. That's too easily adulterated with self-interest. And in a very similar way, the Meniers in my books were founded for good reason, at least at face value. Humanity's in danger. It needs to be saved. And magic might be the only way to do it. But just because that all makes good sense doesn't mean that the people who are allegedly working toward that goal aren't executing evil. Lots of sound logic can still drive people to do great evil. And the means to the end, you know, that sort of philosophy can take what sounds like a good idea, say at first blush, and turn it into something horrific. And in the mini, in, you know, now we have these intellectuals in my fictitious world drinking the blood of the masses and completely severed from the consequences of their selfishness. And, but at least allegedly, they're doing it for good reasons. So, you know, that the idea that something is of sound logic doesn't mean that it's a good idea. And just because something sounds like a good idea when you first hear it, doesn't mean that when you really turn it over, that it's that you need to, that it's a morsel you need to swallow whole cloth. So I think critically evaluate ideas, turn them over in your mind, and then give them a test run. And if it appears that the idea is not bearing out, there are lots of ideas in this world, Rose. So humans are great at coming up with ideas. If something's not working, try a new idea, and don't be afraid of abandoning something that's not working. Go ahead.
So what do you think about the fact that I believe that a lot of good, sounds like good logic, and they indoctrinate people and convince them that even people who are really moral or spiritual or whatever can get caught up, anybody can get caught up in other people's ideas. Yeah. And even if they oppose them in the beginning, there are people who are so manipulative and so genius-like even that can convince you that this evil thing that they're selling like snake oil to the masses or a special group of people, maybe wealthy people, will buy into it thinking it's beneficial to them and then justify it because it is beneficial to them, but the person selling it is actually into greed and becoming wealthier and gain more control and influence over those people. What do you think about that theory?
I mean, I think that always be on the lookout for conflicts of interest and bear in mind that if somebody stands to gain something from converting you over to their opinion about ABC, deserves an extra special strip search before you go buying into whatever they're selling. Because, you know, maybe it's cynical to say, much of life is about sales. People are selling themselves to prospective partners, to prospective businesses, to friends, to clients, et cetera, et cetera. And some people are selling something that's of value and of mutual gain. And some people are selling something that will leave you feeling exploited and naked at the end. And you need to try to figure out, are your interests and this person's interests aligned? Are they going to get something out of you that you'll have no recourse if they convince you or if they can trick you, not even into trusting them, but just trusting them for long enough for you to ink the deal. I mean, accomplished manipulators, they don't need you to trust them. They need you to trust them for just one moment, a critical moment, to lock you into a situation that's bad for you or bad for society writ large. So, you know, do not be rushed into any decision. And the more somebody says, we have to do this right now, you're in danger. The more somebody tells you you're in danger, slow your thinking down. That person is probably a serpent in tall grass.
So that goes into the questions of, do you think even virtuous motivations can become co-opted for evil, which I believe you answered. And why do you suggest slowing down in your house if your house is on fire? That was an interesting comment. Why do you think that? Slow down.
If your house is on fire, like, if you don't keep your wits around you, you're liable to panic, go into a more dangerous situation and imperil yourself, or worse, make it to where somebody else who's not part of the panic can't even save you. You know, slowing down, people are intelligent. Even people who, like, aren't book smart, like, if people have good instincts, if they can just slow themselves down and, you know, move quietly and dispassionately, like even in a school, like, you know, I'm in a school, if there's a fire, we don't tell the kids, run for your lives, children. We say, hey, get quiet, get orderly, and move in using an instinct and a procedure that you've practiced before. Before you find yourself in calamity, either in the literary sense of my books or a figurative sense in your own life, prepare yourself, like, okay, if something terrible happens, what am I going to do? Like, what is my stop, drop, and roll? And once that happens, try to think rationally, because panic, people can use panic. And the more that you're panicked, the more somebody else can take advantage. So do not believe that your house is on fire because somebody says it is. And then even if it is, move with intentionality and intellectualism and an instinct that is patient, because I think panic is more likely to harm you in most circumstances.
Yes, that was intriguing to me, because one time I lived in a Laguna Beach, and a fire started in the condos because somebody left the candle burning.
Oh my God.
And it burned three, and mine was next. And they pounded on my door like at 7 in the morning, and the fire chief, he's like, get out. You have 5 minutes to get out. Grab what you want and get out. Well, 5 minutes in this shocking moment, right, in the early morning when you're having your coffee before going to work.
Yeah.
And so I did think positively, like you said, and slowly, and I said, okay, what do I need? I need the keys to my car. I need to move my car. I need my purse and my wallet.
And your passport.
And I need my pictures. And so those are the things I grabbed, and a change of clothes, and boom, I was out the door in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But you don't have a lot of time to think when they tell you you're out of here in 5 minutes. And and those are the things I needed. I mean, if I didn't, my car was out front, so if it caught on fire, I would have been out of car too. That was what I was thinking about. But now, unfortunately, it's been so intriguing talking to you. Now's your time to shine about your book and to tell our audience anything you want about yourself, your book, and where they can get it, and any contact information you'd like to share.
Sure. Absolutely. Let's see. So if you want to follow, so there's a links to almost everything on my website, theshadowsofthemonolith.com. That's the name of the series, The Shadows of the Monolith. If you just wrote in shadowsofthemonolith.com, that would take you to the same place. There are links and on that website, and you can find the book directly on Amazon or Walmart or Target or BarnesandNoble.com, Kobo, etc. So if you choose your favorite vendor for ebooks or paperback or hardback books, the audiobook will be coming out probably in another week, and it's narrated by a pretty gifted vocal actress, Sharon Lee, that we were very successful, very very delighted that we were able to secure her successfully to participate. So she has quite a good following, and she also is an amazing actress. So the audiobook will be wonderful as well. And you can find me on Instagram, Jonathan Pruitt Author, and you can also find me on Facebook, which is The Shadows of the Monolith, so facebook.com/The Shadows of the Monolith. And there's a professional website there that you can also follow me for updates from my blog, news about forthcoming books, and then various news articles that come out about the book as well, so you can see, you know, all aspects of the drama, both on the page and in my personal life, from my sordid past. Well, and so, you know, it's all available for you guys.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. And we really appreciate your being our very special guest on our show today. And much success with your books and your series. And we will talk to you again maybe in the future within your next series. Your next book in your series, and we are speaking to Jonathan Ann Pruitt, Pruitt. So go out and get a copy of his book. Thank you so much, Jonathan. God bless you. See you again.
And vice versa. Take care, guys. Have a good day. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye. And Jonathan has left the building, and Rose Colombo will have to leave the building as well. So remember, injustices can happen to you, and they can happen to me. But together, we can make a positive difference. Remember, you are never alone when you tune into Colombo Chronicles and the Justice Club. And be sure to go on YouTube, type in Colombo Chronicles on the search box, and subscribe, share, and like, because that is our new YouTube channel that we'd be much appreciative if you do that for us and build up that important information for the world. Thank you.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Colombo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world. Written with an Orwellian twist, will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Colombo, available at Amazon.com.
Well, my friends, time flies. And now is the time to say goodbye. Thanks so much for being part of the Colombo Chronicles family. You are appreciated. Please do it now. Bookmark. Push that like, share, and follow button. Oh, and don't forget to comment below and stay in touch. Make your family part of the Colombo family. Until next Wednesday at noon, remember, God loves you, and so does the Rose.